From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. Your host, Welton Gaddy, is taking the week off, but he left us with a fascinating interview he recorded a couple of weeks ago with Jonathan Edwards, author of the new book, Super Church, The Rhetoric and Politics of American Fundamentalism. Here's how Welton described that conversation.
It's impossible to deny that fundamentalist Christianity exerts enormous influence on our culture and on our government. Despite loud cries of discrimination against people of faith and violations of religious liberty, it is in fact the secular nature of our Constitution that's far more at risk on a regular basis. Are there instances where Christians legitimately feel attacked? Sure. But just like you don't outlaw driving just because sometimes there are car crashes, you don't undermine a brilliant, pluralistic, and long-lasting system of government just because the anecdotal evidence of its imperfection can be found. And yet, all around us, we see attempts to do just that. An invaluable analysis of what's behind much of this impulse, not some conspiracy theory, but a scholarly study of how politically engaged fundamentalist Christians view themselves and the world around them, was published this spring by Dr. Jonathan J. Edwards. It's titled Super Church, The Rhetoric and Politics of American Fundamentalism, and I'll talk with the author later on this week's show.
Before we get to that on this week's show, as we watched debates rage in South Carolina, on Capitol Hill, and elsewhere about the Confederate battle flag and other symbols widely perceived as inexcusably racist, it felt important to revisit a couple of previously aired interviews that will help contextualize the current conversation. So you'll hear civil rights hero Representative John Lewis of Georgia in an interview we first broadcast in February of 2013. But first, since the Supreme Court's earth-shaking ruling on marriage equality last month, one of the themes that has emerged is LGBT people of conscience and their allies turning their attention to other forms of injustice, specifically racial and economic injustice. Even as many challenges remain for sexual minorities in this country, it's been inspiring to hear voices raised in solidarity with other groups. Last week on State of Belief, the Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson exemplified this when Welton Gaddy asked him this question.
What have your prayers been like since the court ruled?
So my prayers have not been about gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, because I know that the famous saying is true, that none of us is free until all of us are free. And so my prayers have really focused on African Americans in this country who live in quite a different America than those of us who are white live in. I think about the Dreamers and other undocumented people in this country who just want a fair shot at being an American citizen. I think of people who live in wheelchairs or who live in poverty or any of those circumstances that puts them on the margins. And my great hope is that now the LGBT community, having secured these rights, will use our strength and our energy to fight for freedom and equality for all of these other groups. Because, as the saying goes, none of us is free until all of us are free.
That answer reminded us of a moving conversation we first aired in July of 2013, right after the Supreme Court handed LGBT Americans a victory on DOMA and Prop 8, but gutted the Voting Rights Act. Our guests were Meg Riley and Rosemary Bray McNatt, two Unitarian Universalist pastors. Their approach to very literally accepting the call to be one's brother's and sister's keeper is as relevant in this moment as it was 2 years ago.
It's exciting that yours is more than a call for unity in the struggle for justice. It is, in fact, a demonstration of that unity. Rosemary, you're an African-American pastor working in New York City with its profound economic and social inequalities. Meg, you're a lesbian pastor with a long history of fighting for marriage equality in Minnesota and nationally. The article that you wrote is headlined, Justice is Justice. And I want to ask each of you, if you will, to briefly define what that word justice means in your ministry and in your life.
Justice is not just us. And whenever you're thinking just us, you're not thinking about justice.
That's right. For me, I really do try to come at it as a pastor. And for me, it is about the fullness of life and about the inherent worth and dignity that all of us really are born with and the capacity to live that out in the world. And anything that blocks that capacity deserves our attention, our focus, our energy to move those obstacles aside. And I really believe that the time has come for people to stop being in silos around which particular issue is the more important issue, because what we know and what we can see is that the people who oppose justice are people who are working against a wide variety of people who they do not believe deserve that fullness of life. It is up to us to twist that narrative and to work together in ways that our opponents don't necessarily expect.
Mm, well said. A number of national and local LGBT groups spoke out immediately against the Supreme Court's ruling on the Voting Rights Act. But the general perception has been, and I underscore perception, the perception has been that for the most part, their focus has been on celebrating victories in the LGBT community. That's understandable, of course. But Meg, what should the LGBT community do now to demonstrate its solidarity with other minority groups?
Well, I think, first of all, something that we've needed to do for years is to facilitate the leadership of the non-white GLBT leaders who have been working hard for years to say this is not two separate communities and really lift them up. Too much of the marriage equality struggle, I think, has been framed as white upper middle class, you know, couples because it's unthreatening. But, you know, groups like the National Black Justice Coalition and many voices have been working for years to lift up other kinds of leadership. And so one thing is to support that. I think a really concrete thing coming up is the centennial on the March on Washington, of which Bayard Rustin, who was one of those many people who's both black and gay, was an absolute architect of that march, takes that opportunity to lift up the unity of the communities and the, you know, 50-year history here. Also, I think for me, it means, you know, I got called recently by somebody saying, you know, now that you have marriage equality in Minnesota, will you help organize Minnesotans to stand up for marriage equality in other states? And I said, you know, that's great you're doing that, and I can give you some names, but really that's not where my energy is going right now. I feel like I put a lot into marriage equality, and I'm really glad other people are, and I really want to put my organizing energy, of which we all have a limited amount when we're ministers, I want to put that into the voting rights, because that's going to be coming up everywhere. And, you know, it's going to require some creative coalition building and some hard work, frankly. It's going to be pretty hard work.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
I feel like I want to see people in Freedom to Marry. I want to see people in the Human Rights Campaign out there in public talking about the danger that we face with Section 4B's dismantling. That this is an issue that strikes at the heart of democracy. Because I really do believe that democracy is in danger in this country right now, and that sounds like a really grand thing to say. But the truth is that in every capacity that I've been able to see, there are forces at work to limit our capacity to speak, to limit our capacity to vote, to limit our capacity for privacy, to limit all those things which make us the democracy and the democratic experiment. New York Public Library, right before the 4th of July, had a copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights on display. And I told somebody, I'm going to go see it because I want to go see the Bill of Rights while we still have one.
Yeah.
That's how seriously I feel about what's happening right now. And so it behooves everybody, no matter what their first issue is, to make sure that they're second issue is democracy, because without that, none of the first issues are going to matter.
The Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt is senior minister of the Fourth Universalist Society in New York City. The Reverend Meg Riley is senior minister of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, a Unitarian congregation without walls. Together, these two authored a powerful call for a recommitment to shared struggle titled Justice is Justice.
As we've watched debates in South Carolina and on Capitol Hill around the Confederate battle flag this past week, in the aftermath of the brutal racist church massacre in Charleston, it's vital to remember two things. First, those flags only went back up as a refutation to integration in the early 60s, the 1960s, and integration was a long and bloody struggle. A survivor of that era is today a respected U.S. congressman. John Lewis marched with Martin Luther King Jr. and today represents the 5th Congressional District of Georgia. Here's an excerpt from a conversation first aired 2.5 years ago on State of Belief.
This is such a unique moment. Martin Luther King's birthday celebration, the inauguration of the first black president to his second term in office. And honestly, I just really wanted to talk with you. You are the person I associate with this kind of moment, and I longed to know what you would be saying about it. What are your thoughts about Monday?
It is very moving that as we celebrate the official holiday for Dr. King, we will be inaugurating the first African-American president for his second term. It's like fate and history coming together. At the same time, this year, during this year, we will be celebrating or commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. I've said on many occasions that Abraham Lincoln freed the slave, but Martin Luther King Jr. liberated a nation. And for President Barack Obama to be using the Bible of Abraham Lincoln and the Bible of Martin Luther King Jr. to take the oath of office, it says something about almost divine intervention. Yes. It says something about the spirit of history. Only God Almighty can make this happen. Mm-hmm. That the sons and daughters of slaves, the sons and daughters of slaveholders can come together and embrace the greatness of this moment. Of these moments, this period, this time, and we all should embrace it.
John, when you were sitting by that bridge down in Selma, Alabama, wiping blood from your head because of the strikes against your face of those who were against you and civil rights, did you ever think this day would come?
48 years ago, during the attempted march from Selma to Montgomery, I never, ever thought that I would live to see a day like we are witnessing now. I couldn't believe in the possibility, but it's here, and we're seeing it. So that's why, from time to time, I share tears of joy and happiness for the distance we've come, for the progress we've made, and for those that didn't live to see this day. They didn't live to see this moment.
John, you know, you knew Martin Luther King Jr. very well. A lot of us knew him, but at a distance. You knew him up close. Sometimes now, as I think about those days, I worry that there are going to be a lot of people who only read this in a history book or see it on a video, and they're not going perhaps to remember the great gift that this man brought to this nation with nonviolence. I wonder if there is a story about your time with Martin Luther King Jr., a personal story that none of us would ever know, but that you could share with us today that all of us might know him more personally, might know him more intimately.
The only story that I could tell that means so much to me personally, back in 1957, when I finished high school, at the age of 17, I wanted to attend a little college about 10 miles from my home called Troy State College.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't admit black students. I grew up very poor, and I didn't have the resources to go away to school. And I thought it would be cheaper and wouldn't be a burden on my parents if I just had an opportunity to go to this little school. So I wrote a letter to Dr. King and told him I needed his help to go to Troy State College. He wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers that I sent this letter to Dr. King. But Dr. King responded and invited me to come to Montgomery. In the meantime, I went away to Nashville to a little school called American Baptist College.
Mm-hmm.
And I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. King, and this teacher was a friend of Dr. King. They both had graduated from Morehouse College together in Atlanta. And Martin Luther King Jr. got back in touch with me and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. On a Saturday morning in March 1958, my father drove me to the Greyhound bus station. I boarded a bus and traveled to Montgomery. And a young lawyer by the name of Fred Gray, who now lives in Tuskegee, met me at the Greyhound bus station and drove me to the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, pastored by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and ushered me into the pastor's study, the office of the church. I saw Dr. King and Reverend Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. I was so scared. I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King spoke up and said, "Are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis?" And I said to Dr. King, "I am John Robert Lewis." I gave him my whole name. And that was the beginning of my relationship. Now, he didn't know me. He didn't know me from anyone, from Adam's house cat. But he took the time to invite me to come up and talk with him about my interest in going to Troy State. But from that moment, we became friends. And I was inspired to become part of the movement to work with him. And if it hadn't been for Dr. King, I don't know what would have happened to me. I don't know what would have happened to so many people. I don't know what would have happened to our nation. He really freed and liberated all of us.
Black and white.
John, one more question. We've made a lot of progress, but we're not there yet. On Monday, as the people of this nation watch the inauguration and celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., what is your word for us as we watch and celebrate?
My simple message would be one of not getting trapped in the ceremony, but think about what this means to America, what this means to the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the message of Dr. King, the message of love, the message of faith, the message of hope, the message of peace, the way of nonviolence. that we must be our brothers and our sisters' keepers, that we must look out for those that have been left out and left behind, and that maybe, just maybe, if we do what we must do and do it right and do it in love and looking out for all humankind, then just maybe, America could emerge as a model for the rest of the world. Dr. King was there in the final analysis, we're one people, we're one family, we're one house. Yeah. We're the American house, but we're also the world house. We all live in the same house.
Congressman John Lewis, I am so very grateful to you for taking time to do this interview. Thank you.
Happy to do it. Thank you so much.
I was taught in Bible college, religion and politics don't mix. And the preacher of the gospel should not comment on, get involved in the political processes in any way. It was a wrong position, but it was one that we were indoctrinated in. We were taught that as young men. The liberal church had never believed that, but we were not, and we actually looked down on it.
The title of Jonathan Edwards' new book is Super Church, The Rhetoric and Politics of American Fundamentalism. In approaching this powerful force in American culture and politics, not as an oppressive, organized cabal, but rather as a category of Americans linked by a common worldview, a shared sense of being under attack, and a set of values and priorities that by definition conflict with some aspects of inclusivity and compromise. Dr. Edwards has done a great service to all of us who struggle to understand the forces defining the times in which we live, and I'm really happy to be able to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. John, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I was so interested in the book because as I started reading, it was actually reading like a history of my childhood because I grew up in a fundamentalist household. And as much of my life as a young man was lived in that environment. And so I'm fascinated by what you've done and think you've done it so well. I wish you would begin in defining the word fundamentalism. I think people use that word frequently, but not always with a careful definition. So what is American fundamentalism?
Well, it's always good to start with the hardest question first.
That's right.
American fundamentalism, I use it in two ways. And I think that it becomes a term that's often used in confusing ways. But I define it in two ways. First of all, it's a particular movement, particular sect within American Protestantism. And that sect or that movement is associated with a particular set of arguments. It started in the 19th century, but really coalesced in the period immediately after the First World War. Mm-hmm. And then the other term, and the term that I think causes everyone so much trouble, is that notion, that reference to fundamentalism after the 1970s, when American Christian fundamentalists became much more visibly political, mm-hmm. that term fundamentalism has sort of traveled widely. Mm-hmm. And now it's gotten ascribed to all kinds of religious, political, economic, and other kinds of movements, and has essentially become a kind of derogatory term. It's just a term we use to denigrate people or groups that we don't like.
Yeah.
And it still has a generally religious overtone to it, mm-hmm. but not always ascribed to religion. So people will talk about Islamic fundamentalism, but they'll also talk about economic fundamentalism mm-hmm. or political fundamentalism.
Yeah. It's very helpful, and I want to pick up on what you said last because I was going to ask you anyway to distinguish. We're talking here about American fundamentalism, people also talk about Jewish fundamentalism and, as you said, Islamic fundamentalism. What is the distinctive between American fundamentalism and which is usually mostly identified with Christian evangelicalism? What's the difference in that and Islamic fundamentalism or Judaic fundamentalism?
In general, I would say the difference has to do with the history.
Mm-hmm.
These are groups who all have their own very distinctive histories and their very distinctive reasons for being. And I think sometimes a term like fundamentalism, which can be useful in some ways, can also tend to conceal those distinctions and differences. Mm-hmm. And so part of my goal in this book was to really take a very close look at the particularities of Christian Protestant mm-hmm. fundamentalism as it had emerged in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And so I make reference to Jewish and Islamic fundamentalism as well, but those are different books and those are different stories, and I didn't want to muddy the water too much
yeah.
by trying to talk about all of them at once.
Exactly, and I understand that. I just thought it's helpful for people to know that there is somewhat of a distinctive nature to what we're talking about that may not be applicable to all of those others. The other thing I wanted to ask you, because of my own experience about American fundamentalism, I, as I said, grew up in a fundamentalist household. I can remember a time when Christian fundamentalism was essentially theological, not political. And
right.
then we saw the insertion of politics, and that took a theological fundamentalism to a whole new level of really trying to work on the idea that you have of super church or Christian nation. Is that right?
I think that's accurate, and part of the story I'm trying to tell is essentially how that took place, how the
mm-hmm.
theological influenced the political.
Right. And I want also, I'd like you to comment on how important an understanding of the history of American fundamentalism is in our particular culture, our political system and belief system.
Sure. I think that fundamentalism is particularly prone to hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentalists talk in hyperbolic terms, and those who talk about fundamentalism tend to talk about it in hyperbolic terms as well. And so I think in order to understand what motivates particular groups of conservatives and particularly Christian conservatives to vote and mobilize and act as they do, it's important to kind of get beneath those headlines,
mm-hmm.
the hyperbole, to really examine what the relationship between the sort of long-held theological positions and this particular historic instantiation of politics.
Mm-hmm. I read you as underscoring the sense of being under attack as essential to a fundamentalist self-concept. Am I reading you correctly?
I think that's accurate, yeah.
Talk about that for a moment, if you will.
Sure. Well, I think, and I suspect you have some sense of this, growing up in a
yes.
fundamentalist family, the roots of fundamentalism really started with interdenominational disputes,
mm-hmm.
Disputes between different groups within Protestantism, Baptists and Presbyterians and so forth, and essentially with conservative wings of those denominations feeling that the dominant forces, the major leaders in those denominations, weren't listening to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that, worse than that, that they were trying to take over, particularly conservative rural churches, and essentially dominate them. And there was some legitimacy in those fears. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there were certain groups who were trying to move in and we're trying to consolidate rural congregations and things like that. But that particular kind of fear really translated into a broader narrative that not just religious leaders, but political leaders as well were attempting to come in and crush or squash or just isolate out religious conservative believers. And that over time started to craft a link between the theological and the political.
John, tell our listeners, please, how then that helps us understand the posture of these Americans toward ideas such as to inclusivity and compromise.
Sure. I think it's important to understand that fundamentalism views itself as continually under attack, that it is continually under threat. And this really has nothing to do with its actual size or actual influence. In the book, I talk about fundamentalism as a discourse in tension or as a kind of paradox, that fundamentalists describe themselves as marginal on the one hand and as a majority or a potential majority on the other. And those two things are at odds with each other, but they also run side by side throughout fundamentalist narratives, and they shift back and forth. And so fundamentalists, no matter how influential they might seem to outsiders, still continue to view themselves as a marginal community that is always under the potential threat of annihilation.
You build your book called Super Church around a series of case studies. I wish you'd talk about maybe why you took that approach and tell us a little bit about how the case studies really do need to inform all of us.
Sure. Part of the reason I chose a series of sermons and films as the case studies I was working through, part of that comes from my own education and background. I'm a student of rhetoric and communication. And so I tend to look at historical narratives through the lens of particular narratives. And in this case, I wanted to pick texts that I thought were representative of broader movements, but also texts that could offer us a sort of lens that would allow us to speak in more specific terms about how the arguments in these movements came together. And so rather than, for example, talking about all of 19th century Protestantism or 19th century evangelicalism, I use Charles Finney's 1835 Lectures on the Revivals of Religion as a case study to basically get into the language and the specific arguments that revivalists were making at that time, and to hopefully craft a better, more specific understanding of how the language has changed and adapted over the past, really, the past century, but the past couple of hundred years, to embrace the political as well as the theological.
Would you say that the case studies that you worked with and reported on illustrate a basic failure among non-fundamentalists to understand what drives fundamentalists?
I think that's probably accurate. One of the things that I wanted to do in picking the specific case studies that I did was to avoid going for what I thought of as the most obvious. There are certain names and certain texts and ideas that pop up over and over and over again if you read or follow the people who study fundamentalism. And so names like James Dobson and Jerry Falwell repeat over and over. And I wanted to pick texts that I thought would be less familiar to people. And so while I did, for example, do a chapter talking about Jerry Falwell because of his influence in crafting the Moral Majority, I chose to really focus my attention on the Jerry Falwell of 1971, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Jerry Falwell of 1979 when the moral majority came into being, because I was really interested in how Falwell in the early 70s was crafting a theology of the church that really influenced his political leanings over the course of the decade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there scenarios you can imagine where fundamentalist values would encourage accommodation and compromise?
It's a good question. I think that it's a kind of squaring the circle problem. So there is an inherent tension between the fundamentalist desire to be true to the Bible, at least true to the Bible in a fundamentalist interpretation of it,
mm-hmm.
and the desire to function politically and mm-hmm. to be politically effective in a democratic society necessarily involves a certain amount of compromise, or at least an ability to play nice with others
mm-hmm.
on the outside. And I think that different fundamentalist and evangelical groups have been better or worse at squaring that circle than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some, I think, are more effective at engaging with politics, but to the degree that they engage politically, they often offend the more isolationist, separatist, or sort of theologically purist
mm-hmm.
elements of their own denominations and their own movements. Jerry Falwell is a good example. And when he founded the Moral Majority, he compromised by, allowing membership from Mormons, from Catholics, from conservative Jewish leaders, and this offended a lot of the more separatist movements and wings within fundamentalism.
Yeah.
And so for some fundamentalists, Jerry Falwell ceased to be a true fundamentalist. He ceased to be pure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And certainly groups like Willow Creek Community Church, the mega churches that I talk about later in the book, are for many fundamentalists simply not fundamentalist at all, that they've gone too far in accommodating themselves, both politically and theologically, to the outside world.
That relates to the next question I really want to ask you, because it seems to me, and I guess I know Falwell better than I know some of the others, that we had debated each other on TV and so forth, but I saw him doing the movement that he made because it was beneficial to building a larger base to motivate in the whole culture war.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Yeah.
I think he saw it as a compromise, but a necessary compromise.
Right, right.
That in order to be politically effective, he had to, I don't know if abandon is quite the word that he would use, but certainly move away from or de-emphasize some of the fundamentals of doctrine. In order to be politically effective, he had to become less theologically pure.
Right, right. I do have to ask, how do these fundamentalist values, as you identify them, come into play in the great culture war issues of the day, reproductive rights, marriage equality, and do they help explain the threat of defiance like we're hearing in terms of an expected Supreme Court ruling on support for marriage equality?
I think it helps in the sense that one of the things I emphasize in the book is that fundamentalism is and really can be best understood as a local movement or a mm-hmm. movement that emphasizes local politics and really has been most effective at the level of local politics.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentalists entering into the national political arena haven't really had that much success.
Mm-hmm.
Conservative politicians often promise things in order to get evangelical or fundamentalist votes, but they don't really deliver, certainly not on a lot of the social issues that fundamentalist leaders care about. But at the level of local politics, they can often be much more effective. Mm-hmm. And so you see things like arguments over Ten Commandments displays, mm-hmm. or Koresh's, or arguments over the role of public schools in particular cases where, you know, local communities refuse to abide by a kind of holy separation of church and state model. They try mm-hmm. to integrate kinds of prayers or readings from the Bible, things like that. And I think you see a similar argument at work with defiance over same-sex marriage mm-hmm. and what they see as a threat from the federal court in the, what I think is probably likely ruling from the Supreme Court mm-hmm. on same-sex marriage rights. This ties into the notion that the federal is opposing or imposing its values on the local.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a national perspective, those politics aren't likely to go far. But I think where you're going to see the resistance popping up and where it's going to continue for some time is at the level of local businesses, local churches, local parachurch organizations, mm-hmm. and things like that.
Yeah.
And they'll push it as far as they can. They'll yield when they have to, but it will be in some ways a war that defines, although I don't think that same-sex marriage will ever become the defining issue that abortion rights became right. in the 1980s, 1990s.
John, what's the one thing that you'd like any reader of your book, Super Church, to take away with them once they've read it?
I think it's always hard to ask an author to stick with one thing. I can think of two things.
Okay, do two.
And these are both things that I've mentioned a little bit before.
Uh-huh.
One is the importance of understanding movements in context.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to understand how a community defines itself on its own terms. And I think that's particularly important when you're dealing with kind of extremist rhetoric that you see coming out of fundamentalists and even some evangelical communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is it's important to look at how a community talks to itself.
Hmm. Yeah.
In other words, the thing that I think distinguishes my book from a lot of the other books out there on fundamentalism and evangelicalism is I'm predominantly interested in how fundamentalists and evangelicals talk to themselves.
Yeah.
And how they justified theological conservatism and political conservatism within their own communities. Because I think once you have an understanding of how these groups speak to one another,
mm-hmm.
you can much more effectively understand and hopefully engage with how they speak to outsiders and how they talk in political terms.
You do a good job of describing fundamentalism in many different ways and allowing the reader to come to his or her own opinion about fundamentalism, and that's a very strong point of it. One last question, and I'm way over time already, but what did writing this book do to you?
I came into this project thinking that I was at Northwestern University. I was pursuing my PhD, and this started off as what I thought was going to be an analysis of the politics of megachurches. Mm-hmm. I was sort of fascinated by megachurches as an institution. And I realized very quickly that megachurches, first of all, were a lot older than I thought they were. I had assumed that they were something that had emerged in the 1980s, but mm-hmm. there are examples that go back well into the 19th century. And I think as the project started to evolve, and I realized that I really wanted to look at how this tension between religious progressives and conservatives,
mm-hmm.
how that tension evolved and emerged, I think it left me with a much richer understanding of fundamentalist traditions, many of which are not. I'm somewhat familiar with some of those narratives, but most of what I talk about in the book was new to me as I was examining it, exploring it. And so I came away with a much richer understanding of why fundamentalists make the arguments that they do and why those arguments continue to resonate. And I didn't come away with a idealistic sense that we were somehow going to all start getting along with one another. Or that, you know, fundamentalists and progressives were going to be able to find common ground, because I don't think that that's possible. And, and some books have made that argument. I don't think that finding common ground is really the goal. I did come away with a sense that if you can take someone's story, take someone's rhetoric on its own terms, you can hopefully be able to argue better. You may not come to an agreement, you may not come to anything like consensus, but hopefully we can learn to argue more effectively with one another. And if we can do that, hopefully we can craft a stronger democracy as a result.
Dr. Jonathan J. Edwards is instructor of speech, communication, and rhetoric at the University of South Carolina. His invaluable new book is titled Super Church, The Rhetoric and Politics of American Fundamentalism. John, I think this is an essential work. I appreciate what you did in research and writing. I really appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We need you to help us spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.